In what will be our final visit into the history of boxing equipment, we'll begin by looking at the origin of the boxing ring itself. Not taking into account early Greek and Roman gladiatorial games, early bare-knuckle bouts were waged toe-to-toe. Fighters literally drew a line on the ground and faced each other. That's where the common phrase "toe the line" originated from. The actual first square, modern-day boxing ring was introduced by the Pugilistic Society in 1838. It measured 24 feet across and was surrounded by two ropes. It would be considered primitive compared to today's boxing ring, but it set the tone for the more advanced platforms we now see in almost every gym and boxing event today. Having said that, boxing rings weren't widely adopted right away, and the reason is that for a period of time around 1895 to 1919, boxing was outlawed, so bouts took place underground and were moved from place to place in order for the organizers and participants to avoid being arrested. That situation, of course, wouldn't allow for rings or structures to be built, so the ring just basically consisted of the spectators standing in a circle holding a rope to signify the perimeter for the combatants to fight within. This is also how it was done when early adopters of the sport would roam from town to village while traveling with fairs or carnivals. They would crown themselves the champion of some territory, this or that place, proclaiming, you know, I am the true boxing champion of the East or whatever. And they would draw a crowd who would then hold a rope to create a ring around the two contestants. The self-proclaimed reigning champion would go on to challenge any of the men to an exhibition fight. Anyone who was brave enough would throw their hat in the ring to accept, which is also another phrase you still hear used today in day-to-day conversation. And while we're at it, kind of a sidebar, another phrase or term that came about in the late 1600s was the term second. That's, of course, your corner man or corner men. But back then, the term originated because they were second-line boxers, meaning they might actually be called on to fight if the first scheduled bout ended too quickly. So a second was kind of like a backup quarterback. These seconds or cornermen would also take a knee in between rounds, so the fighter had something to sit or rest on in between rounds. So I guess that could also be considered the history of the corner stool. On top of that, although now we call anyone in the corner a chief second or second, depending on their role, back then the second was just called the bottle man, which is just a funny tidbit, but not really a flattering title. Anyway, bringing it back to actual rings, although it was originally called a ring because these roped-off spectators or contests were fought in a drawn circle on the ground, you fast forward to modern-day boxing rings, and we've seen some pretty major improvements in the past 60 years. Components of a boxing ring, such as corner cushions and turnbuckle covers, were slowly introduced as additional safety was needed and greater precautions took place. One instance was after Emil Griffith stopped Benny Perrette in the 12th round of their third meeting in 1962. The first form of corner cushions and turnbuckle covers began to be used in some states and title fights. This came about because Griffith was able to pin Perrette in the corner and land a barrage of unanswered punches. Perrette would ultimately lapse into a coma and die. Some believe that additional padding could have reduced the effect of the punches. Of course, there's no way of really knowing that, if it would have actually had any effect on the outcome or not. But regardless, it became a necessary and positive change. Because of the number of stories and scenes we've witnessed of fighters being knocked out of or falling out of the ring, you'd think that rope spacers would have come along sooner, but they actually didn't begin being implemented until the early 1980s. Some have concluded that Muhammad Ali's ability to lay back and rope-a-dope against George Foreman started the discussion about them, but you don't really see them in wide use until 3 or 4 years after that. That pretty much brings us up to speed with the modern-day boxing rings you see now. They're heavily padded and provide a heavy-duty secure stage for some of boxing's best matchups. Since making weight is such a big part of the fight game, let's look back at sauna suits. Sauna suits and their benefits were first introduced in 1967 by Manuel Greenwald, who had a Florida-based mail-order gift and novelty catalog business. That's where the Swedish sauna suit would first be advertised to the masses as a personal steam bath that would enable anyone to melt pounds away. The catalog boasted that either by exercising while wearing the suit or by doing nothing other than wearing it around the house while doing ordinary household chores, any man or woman could lose inches and feel more refreshed. His ads claimed that the sauna suit burns up calories as you exercise, similar to a Swedish bath. The Swedish bathhouses, you know, which gained some level of popularity in America in the late 1920s and early 1930s, were a four-step process of extreme damp heat, steam, massage, and cold. These were prominent and were believed to help you lose weight, open your pores, cleanse out impurities, or sweat out illness. So that's where the name Swedish sauna came into play and made its way into the marketing of this revolutionary product concept. Then we jump forward to when the sauna suit really made its presence known in athletics, which was through the wrestling field. It gained a bunch of notoriety when a publication reported the story of a young high school wrestler named Chris Pickett, who in 1977 weighed 155 pounds, but then realized his best chance to get a competitive edge over his opponents was to make a drastic weight cut down to 135 pounds. The article said to make weight for weigh-ins, Pickett would run 5 miles in the rubber sauna suit the day before a match, then take a sauna bath. Then he would run again and hit the sauna again all the morning of the weigh-ins. The story caught on, and soon sauna suits became a staple of every wrestling program at every level across the country. Then it finally made its crossover into the fight game in the 1990s. It happened in a kind of an odd way because it was part of a non-successful story. When 1988 Olympian Michael Carbajal fought and beat Mungai Kitakesam of Thailand for the IBF light flyweight title, it was reported that his opponent had tremendous difficulty making the 108-pound weight limit, but was able to get there by jumping rope while wearing a sauna suit in 104-degree heat for 2 hours. That enabled him to lose his final 1.5 pounds. Even though Carbajal knocked out the exhausted, previously unbeaten Kitakesam in 7 short rounds, the term sauna suit and awareness of its potential had been planted, and other boxers began using the suits to drop weight. You know, now you see them as a regular part of a fighter's daily routine in training camps all the time. Although we've become more educated on what they really achieve, there are still some misconceptions about what they are and are not good for. So, since we're on the topic, let's be clear. Sauna suits do not increase your metabolism. They do not increase the amount of calories burned, and they do not increase training intensity. What they do by sweating out is gives you a fairly accurate assessment of your weight, so you can better determine what your actual weight is versus water weight. That can, in turn, allow you to make weight more accurately when the time comes. Sauna suits can also help you adapt to fighting in hotter environments because your body becomes acclimated to the intense heat they trap in. They can also be highly beneficial to use when warming up, especially if you have trouble working up a sweat. Losing water weight, which sauna suits do help, can also improve the recovery process. You know, all in all, sauna suits are like most everything else. Used in excess, they can be detrimental. But when used wisely and correctly, they can add another advantage to the range of training devices you have at your disposal. And finally, the last piece of equipment we'll be discussing in our Boxing Equipment History podcast series is body protectors. Although it's obvious that fighters of the past realized the importance of practicing body punching, an actual body protector, like what we use today, didn't come about until the mid-1980s. Before that, you can find images of fighters like early 1900s middleweight champion Stanley Ketchell using a chair cushion, or other images that appear to have their sparring partners wearing thinly padded aprons. So although the idea of body protection has existed for over a century, they only really took full form around 40 years ago. The first body protector was released around 1987 and was patterned after a common piece of karate or taekwondo equipment that was used in point fighting competitions. Similar to boxing, competitors were assigned a red or blue corner, and they would wear these types of chest guards for protection. They were modified for boxing and used in training by combining them with a thicker style chest guard, like what you would see on a baseball umpire. The hybrid of these two are what really brought about today's modern body protector. What coaches use today are obviously much more padded, more shock absorbing, and fit better than a chair cushion. Plus, we now have the advantage of technologically advanced foams, gel padding, memory foam, and a variety of multi-layer materials that provide greater impact absorption and protection than ever before. And that wraps up our History of Boxing Equipment series. I hope that the entire 7 episodes have provided some insights and an appreciation for how far we've come as a sport and in this industry. I and everyone at Tidal Boxing take great pride in constant advancements in safety, convenience, and quality equipment that is taking place in the fight game today. We are still constantly testing, researching, and conceptualizing greater ways to improve upon and impact this great sport. I personally want to thank you for taking this trip with me into our boxing past, and please come along with us as we continue to innovate boxing's future.
Thank you for watching this episode of Title Unboxed. If you're anything like me, you can never get too much boxing. So if you'd like to watch more episodes, you can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and on our Title Boxing YouTube page.